Welcome to RISE, Radio Internet Story Exchange, a weekly public affairs program helping you to ask questions, find answers, and distinguish the truth from the lie. I'm Kelia Ramirez. Today's topic is Iraq, Behind the Headlines. I'm recording this on December 8, 2002. Earlier today, Iraq turned over a report on its chemical, biological, and nuclear programs to the United Nations. The documents are voluminous, more than 12,000 pages plus computer disks. But the Iraqis are saying that it could be summed up in one sentence: we no longer have any weapons of mass destruction. The White House is still insisting that Iraq has such weapons. But Iraqi Lieutenant General Amr al-Sadi, a former chief of military production for Iraq, called his country's declarations accurate and truthful. And so far, UN weapons inspectors currently in Iraq have found nothing that would give lie to that assertion. Al-Sadi has also challenged the U.S. to provide what evidence it has about supposed Iraqi weapons to the UN inspectors. Meanwhile, Senator Bob Graham, Democrat of Florida and chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee, told CBS's Face the Nation, quote, "We are in possession of what I think to be compelling evidence," unquote, of the Iraqi weapons program. Thus far, the White House has refused to release its claimed evidence. And it may not choose to. It doesn't matter. The U.S. is going to invade Iraq. The troops are deployed. Command exercises are being held in Qatar. You don't go that far and then just change your mind, pack up, and go home. The weapons of mass destruction issue that is splashed all over the headlines is a red herring. Consider that Pakistan has nuclear weapons, and its population includes supporters of Al-Qaeda, the presumed agents of the 9/11 attacks. Pakistan's president, Pervez Musharraf, is a military strongman who forced his way into power. Yet we don't hear George W. Bush demanding that Pakistan disarm under threat of war. There are two differences between Pakistan and Iraq. The first is Saddam Hussein. It's personal between the Bushes and Saddam. The second is oil. We'll look at both of these issues today, beginning with former UN weapons inspector Scott Ritter. He has written and produced a documentary called In Shifting Sands: The Truth About UNSCOM and the Disarming of Iraq. The documentary, written and directed by Ritter, tells the story of the successes and failures of the UNSCOM weapons inspection team in Iraq from 1991 to 1998. On November 14, 2002, Ritter appeared at San Francisco's Roxy Cinema to answer questions from the audience between showings of the film. Here are some of Ritter's comments.
Okay, the question, how did I get access and when did I get access to the Iraqi government? This was a tough one. You have to understand, and I think it came across in the film, that I was pretty much demonized by the Iraqis. I'm a CIA spy, a tool of the Mossad. Abu Azamat is the term the Iraqis use, the father of all crisis. And suddenly, you know, I leave the job in 1998, and suddenly there I am trying to knock on the door in 2000 saying, hey, let me back in, I'd like to make a movie. The Iraqis went, sure. But the bottom line is that, in answer to the question, in the 7 years that I was a weapons inspector in Iraq, I got a reputation for two things. One being just a total pain in the ass. I was a hard-nosed SOB that held the Iraqis fully accountable to their obligations to disarm in accordance with the rule of law. And two, I never lied to them. Ever. I was straightforward and honest with them the whole time. They had a job to do, and I made sure they adhered to their responsibility. But I also ensured that when I put my inspectors on the ground, we adhered to our responsibilities. My inspection team was about disarming Iraq, not about taking out Saddam Hussein. So when I came to the Iraqis in 2000 and said that I'd like to make a movie that honestly portrays the events, the Iraqi government, while skeptical, heard me out and then eventually opened the doors. Most of the film you've seen here of the inspections came from the Iraqi government. I went to the United Nations and asked the United Nations to open up their archive of inspector film. They refused to do so. I went to the Iraqi government and asked them to open up their archive, and they gave me 100% access. It's stunning which side is afraid of the truth. How popular is Saddam Hussein? Saddam Hussein is a brutal, tyrannical dictator who governs through the rule of fear. Saddam Hussein is a leader that took Iraq from third world status in the 1960s to one of the most advanced nation states by 1980. Saddam Hussein is a man who has tortured to death tens of thousands of Iraqis. Saddam Hussein is a man who has created universal health care in Iraq, universal education in Iraq, unique among Arab nations. He has provided education opportunities not only for men, but for women. So how do you judge Saddam Hussein? That's a tough one. Do the Iraqi people love him to the degree that he thinks he's loved? Do the Iraqi people truly, they vote 100% to keep him in office? No. If the United States invades Iraq, will the Iraqi people drop everything they can and rally around the United States? No. Use a historical analogy. In 1941, June 1941, when the Germans invaded Russia, did the Russians love Joseph Stalin? I don't think so. Joseph Stalin had spent several years purging the Russian military, eviscerating the officer corps. You think the Russian army is ready to fight and die for Joseph Stalin? I don't think so. You think the Russian people are ready to fight and die for Joseph Stalin? Not on your life. You just butchered them, starved millions to death, sent millions more off to rot in a gulag. But when the Germans came across the border, the Russian people fought and died for Mother Russia. If we go across the border into Iraq, my gut feeling is that the Iraqi people will fight and die for Iraq. Not for Saddam Hussein, but for Iraq. If there's no weapons of mass destruction found by the current regime of inspectors going in, can the evidence be faked? They don't need to fake the evidence. They don't need to fake it. You see, we got a resolution in place, ladies and gentlemen, called Resolution 1441. Now, according to the French, Russians, and Chinese, they've removed all hidden traps in this resolution, triggers for war. It's supposed to be a fair and balanced resolution. On the surface, it is. It says the Iraqis can never again return to the tactics of cheat and retreat that myself and the other inspectors suffered through 7 years. For inspections to work in Iraq, Iraq must be fully compliant. Iraq must allow inspectors immediate access to sites designated for inspection. That's the only way the system will work. If Iraq does so, and it doesn't have any weapons, the inspectors will be able to verify that. If Iraq allows the inspectors access, but they're trying to hide weapons, I guarantee the inspectors will find it. What the Bush administration fears is the inspectors going in and not finding any weapons. You see, because the Bush administration's policy isn't to disarm Iraq, it's to get rid of Saddam Hussein. If you send inspectors into Iraq and they don't find any weapons, there has to be a finding of compliance. If there's a finding of compliance, you have to lift economic sanctions. If you lift economic sanctions, you break containment of Iraq, which means Iraq comes back into the fold of the international community with Saddam Hussein still in power, which is the last thing we want. So the hidden trap is paragraph 4 of this resolution. Paragraph 4 says that any omission on the part of Iraq in regards to its declaration, which is due, by the way, on December 8th, its declaration about weapons of mass destruction constitutes a continuing material breach, which will be used to justify war. Iraq today, or yesterday, in accepting the return of inspectors, said, we don't have any weapons of mass destruction. The inspectors are welcome to come in. So we know what their resolution, what their declaration is going to say on December 8th. We have no weapons. Condoleezza Rice, the National Security Advisor to the President of the United States, said last Sunday that Iraq has chemical and biological weapons. And if Iraq fails to declare these on December 8th, that'll show that Iraq has no intention of complying with this resolution, and that there's no reason to go forward with the inspections, because we know that means Iraq is just cheating. And therefore, we will cite the Iraqi declaration as having serious omissions of fact, thereby triggering war. We don't need to fabricate. We just built in a basis for semantic abuse, which is what's going to occur. Mark my word, December 8th through December 15th, you're going to see a very interesting debate and dialogue here in the United States and in the Security Council as the United States and Great Britain seeks to make a case for war in Iraq based upon the fact that the Iraqis say we don't have any weapons of mass destruction. The National Security Strategy document, which speaks of American unilateralism, says the United States will take advantage of its overwhelming military and economic strength to impose American unilateral solutions on problems unilaterally defined by the United States. We will not allow any nation to be our equal, economically or militarily, and we will preemptively strike those who seek to acquire equality. We will preemptively strike any nation that we deem to be a threat to the United States, that we deem to be a threat, regardless of what international law says. So Iraq merely is the case study for implementation of this new Bush doctrine of American imperial power. And the next nation, I think, is going to be Saudi Arabia. I think the United States fully has the intention, in accordance with this new Bush doctrine, to gain control over the major oil-producing regions of the Middle East. Iraq will be first. Saudi Arabia will be second, Iran will be third, and we will have a never-ending cycle of colonial war and violence. Welcome to the new generation. George W. Bush came in saying that he's going to get rid of Stalin. That's his policy objective, and he has sworn that he's going to accomplish this. He had a tough time doing that up until September 11, 2001. The American people weren't buying into this war on Iraq. After September 11th, though, W's been able to play on the fear and ignorance of the American public and put forward Iraq as a threat, and the people buy into it. And now he intimidates the people by saying that you're either with me or against me on this war. There's no room for question. If you question, it's an unpatriotic act. And as a result, it looks like we're going to war. And it's one of the reasons that the American public has been successfully conditioned over the course of over a decade now to accept the concept of confrontation with Iraq in order to get rid of Saddam Hussein. It's stunning that when we think of a nation of 23 million people with as much religious and ethnic diversity as Iraq, that we personify that nation in the form of one man, Saddam Hussein. That's where we're at today, and regardless of who the president is, they're going to have to deal with that reality, deal with the fact that the American public has been conditioned for confrontation with Iraq. Conditioned, I mean, sickeningly conditioned to the point that we don't even blush when we talk about 500,000 Iraqi children dead. We don't even blush. We just say, oh, wow, okay, I guess that's up next. What time is Will and Grace on? But that's how we as a nation deal with the situation in Iraq. When we're talking about a war with Iraq where we're going to slaughter tens of thousands of Iraqi civilians and probably have the result of hundreds of thousands of deaths resulting from disease, etc., we're not even blushing. This is an American problem. It's not a problem of any given administration. The question is, what are we, the people of the United States, going to do about it?
That was former U.N. Weapons Inspector Scott Ritter. The name of his documentary is In Shifting Sands, The Truth About UNSCOM and the Disarming of Iraq. A link to a transcript of the Q&A is on the front page of the RISE website, www.riseforNews.net. That's www.riseforNews.net. You are listening to RISE, Radio Internet Story Exchange. I'm Kelia Ramirez. RISE now presents to you a documentary called Collateral Voices, created by award-winning independent journalist Jeremy Scahill. The documentary, which was first distributed in July 2002, comes to us through iraqjournal.org, a forum for the distribution of independent information and views from Iraq.
Iraq, one of the most ancient civilizations on Earth, home of the Garden of Eden, Babylon, the ancient city of Ur, an oil-rich country blessed with an abundance of natural resources, home to the mighty Tigris and the immortal Euphrates. Iraqis pride themselves on being some of the oldest and richest people on Earth, but for 12 years, Iraq's 22 million people have lived in pure misery, in the cradle of civilization. They live under an unprecedented regime of economic sanctions and regular U.S. bombings, in a land polluted from a war that for them has never ended. A country once praised for having the most advanced medical and education systems in the Middle East has been hurled back generations. Estimates drawn from UN figures say that as many as 1 million children have died as a direct result of the sanctions. All of this while Saddam Hussein remains firmly in power. Now, more than a decade after the Gulf War, George W. Bush is resurrecting his father's unfulfilled promise to bring down Saddam.
Iraq continues to flaunt its hostility toward America and to support terror. This is a regime that has something to hide from the civilized world. States like these and their terrorist allies constitute an axis of evil, arming to threaten the peace of the world. The price of indifference would be catastrophic, and all nations should know America will do what is necessary to ensure our nation's security.
Down, down, Bush! Down, down, Bush! Down, down, Bush! Down.
It's a chant that hasn't been heard in Iraq since the 1991 Gulf War. Down, down, Bush. This chant wasn't written for the current U.S. president. It was the rally cry here against his father a decade ago, during the war the Iraqis call the mother of all battles. But with Little Bush, as the Iraqis call him, threatening a new war, the chant is making a comeback.
Down, down, Bush! Down, down, Bush! Down, down, Bush!
Iraqis everywhere are well aware of Bush's specific threat to change the regime in Baghdad. But 12 years of deadly economic sanctions and almost constant bombardment have smashed any potential support the administration could hope to win inside the country. Even those Iraqis who are against Saddam Hussein say they would never support a change of government brought about by a Washington-orchestrated coup or another massive bombing. With our souls, with our blood, we will defend you, O Saddam. In Iraq today, chants like these have taken on a new meaning. They've come to represent not the people's undying love for their president, but a message of defiance against Washington.
Our president is our decision. It's not America's business. America chose Bush. We chose Saddam. We didn't interfere with who you decided for president. We're free. We choose our leadership. Who's Bush to tell us who's good for us and who's not?
Bush's threats are making the government in Baghdad all the more powerful. Already, most Iraqis live in a state of fear and terror. Saddam Hussein's name is almost never mentioned in any context, on the streets, in the souks, or in the taxis. The threat of war has led to an even further lockdown of the country, with secret police watching everyone. Public opposition to the regime is unheard of. But the people view America, and not Saddam, as the primary source of their misery, with almost everyone vowing to resist any American attack, regardless of what Bush states is the goal. Senior Iraqi officials say they believe the U.S. will attack sometime in the next year, but they say Bush will not succeed in bringing down the government. Dr. Abdul al-Hashimi is an influential member of Saddam Hussein's Ba'ath Party and a former federal minister.
The threat is there. American military activities is on every day in Iraq in the no-fly zones. So one thing we can do, and we know for sure that we can defend Iraq, one thing we know for sure that we can prevent American administration from achieving its objectives in Iraq, that one thing for sure we know. But when the American administration is going to decide to hit Iraq, they will do that. And they will find an excuse for themselves to do that. Nothing we can do about it.
Our second goal is to prevent regimes that sponsor terror from threatening America.
Some say that war with Iraq was inevitable with George W. Bush in the White House. Several senior members of the administration were key players during the elder Bush's war against Iraq in 1991, people like Colin Powell and Dick Cheney. But this time around, there was one event that set the wheels for war against Iraq in motion.
At about 8:45 Eastern time this morning, a jet plane hit one of the World Trade Center towers in New York City. Within 20 minutes, a second larger jet hit the other tower. Smoke and flames.
Iraq is clearly feeling the impact of the September 11th attacks in a very real way. In the weeks following those attacks, the Bush administration dispatched former CIA Director James Woolsey to Europe. His mission? To find a link between the attacks and Iraq. Despite stories of secret meetings in Prague between Iraqi diplomats and one of the alleged hijackers, Mohammed Atta, no evidence has been presented to suggest Baghdad had even a remote connection to September 11th. Woolsey's secret mission has now been swept away from any public discussion. But the Bush administration has pushed ahead, implying at every turn that Iraq supports terrorism, the kind of terrorism that took place at the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. Saddam's inner circle is well aware of the post-September 11th reality in which they now find themselves. Iraq's number two man, Deputy Prime Minister Tariq Aziz, spoke exclusively to Free Speech Radio News at his office in Baghdad. He's the senior-most Iraqi official to speak to a Western reporter since September 11th.
Well, Iraq has nothing to do with those events. We saw them on television as many people in the whole world, and the United States saw them. We do not condone the killing of people, you see. We do not rejoice that. But the American government is using those tragic events in pushing forward towards a very belligerent militaristic policy, global-wise, you see, which is a real threat to the whole world, as it is a threat to Iraq because they are targeting Iraq as one of their next victims in the so-called war against terrorism. All the pretexts which are being used against Iraq and the leadership of Iraq are false pretexts. The issue, as it was said, is oil. The issue is to impose American imperialistic control on Iraq in order to use the resources of Iraq for the benefit, for the greedy interest of American capitalism. This is the issue.
In mid-June, a secret directive by the Bush administration was leaked to the U.S. press. It said that the president had authorized the CIA and U.S. special forces to conduct covert operations inside Iraq, authorizing them to use lethal force to capture Saddam Hussein. The directive also said the forces could kill the Iraqi leader. For the Iraqis, this report was nothing new. Over the last decade, Saddam has survived more than 10 attempts on his life, many of these orchestrated by the CIA. Most seasoned observers in Iraq say that Saddam is more powerful, more entrenched than ever before since the Gulf War. His intelligence service and secret police, the Mukhabarat, operate an extensive network of counter-espionage agents and agencies. They work both inside and outside Iraq with just one task: to keep Saddam alive and in power.
The United States, they think that, you know, that the people around Saddam are against him. This is untrue, you know, and this is can't be done at all, you know. It's easy to say it, but it's very difficult to implement it.
Hassan Hafid is a veteran Iraqi political analyst. He has studied Saddam's security infrastructure.
Iraq is different from Afghanistan. Iraq is a state, you know, with a well-established government. This government has contacts with many countries in the world, among them Arab countries, of course. They have also the military to defend themselves, organized military, and they have also rank-and-file Ba'athists who can be numbered in millions, actually, who are ready to defy and to die to defend their government, actually. It is, for the United States, an axis of evil, but for many other countries, it's not an axis of evil.
Another part of the U.S. strategy is working with opposition groups. In late May, media reports uncovered that the Bush administration was increasing its funding of exile groups opposed to Saddam Hussein, giving them more weapons, equipment, training, and intelligence information. Groups like the London-based Iraqi National Congress, an organization that's worked consistently with the CIA over the last decade, coordinating at least one unsuccessful assassination attempt on Saddam. But despite their high profile in Washington, these groups have little, if any, following inside Iraq. As one observer put it, they have more of a constituency along the Potomac than they do along the Tigris or Euphrates. The U.S. also touts the Kurds of northern Iraq as a potential force against Saddam. But even the leaders of these groups have expressed a reluctance to fight in a U.S.-sponsored attack on Baghdad. Deputy Prime Minister Tariq Aziz laughs at the idea that any of these groups working with Washington pose a threat to Saddam's grip on power.
Frankly speaking, we do not care about all these activities because they are a complete failure. There isn't an opposition to our leadership that can have integrity and respectability. That's not the issue. The issue or the real concern is when the bombs are thrown at our people. America can throw bombs and missiles at any place in Iraq, and that creates death and destruction. But we are not worried about the opposition, you see. Let them do what they want. They are spending their own money, the taxpayer money, you see, on those people who are worthless and who cannot do anything serious.
Almost no one in Iraq believes that Bush will succeed in removing Saddam through covert action, or even a repeat of the type of attack witnessed during the Gulf War, a war which left more than 250,000 Iraqis dead. But what they fear is that Bush has inherited what they call his father's wimp complex, that he's obsessed with seeing Saddam taken out at any cost. What that would mean, they say, is a total military annihilation of the country. This is the only scenario that analysts like Hassan Hafid can envision, leading to Bush fulfilling his promise of taking out Saddam.
If the United States and Britain are going to sort of to reduce the country to rubble, you know, to kill a lot of people, you know, and attack, you know, and destroy everything, you know, definitely there will not be, you know, people and no regime at all. That can be happen like that, but it means that sort of they should do a genocide to the whole country.
On the outskirts of Baghdad in the Old Canal Hotel lies the massive UN compound behind gigantic fences of barbed wire.
I'm the coordinator, and you probably must be wondering what I'm still doing here.
Inside, the head of the UN humanitarian program is beginning to pack up his things. After 2 years in Baghdad, he's moving on. Burmese diplomat Tun Myat is the first humanitarian coordinator in 6 years to finish out his term without resigning. His predecessors, Dennis Halliday and Hans von Spanek, both quit the post in protest of the sanctions, saying they could no longer participate in what they called a genocide against innocent Iraqis. Tun Myat says if he thought the sanctions would be lifted as a result of his resignation, he would already be gone. Myat monitors very closely what's being said by the Bush administration, and he fears the worst if the U.S. decides to attack Iraq.
If there is going to be total war, nothing less than catastrophe will follow. You're going to have hit again all the bridges, the roads, the infrastructure, the railways, the electricity grid again, which is still being it's half alive, coming up again. The government has spent huge sums of money for that. And the water and sanitation systems that are in such dilapidated state are coming up slowly again. All the last 5-6 years, we have painstakingly all put together piece by piece, getting clearance for this or clearance for that, bringing it all together. All that is going to go to waste. So you can understand the effect that will have on the people.
As Iraqis again begin bracing themselves for another massive attack, they spend most of their days and nights struggling to survive the war that's never left them since 1991, the war of economic sanctions. Nowhere has this policy been more devastating than in the Shiite-dominated south of Iraq. It's this region that George W. Bush has said will be one of the hotbeds of anti-Saddam activity in the event of war. Welcome to the Basra Pediatric Hospital in southern Iraq. One needs only to walk down the hospital's corridors to understand why most Shiites have no interest in working with America. The beds are full of children dying of cancer and infants born with severe congenital deformities or birth defects. Children born with their noses above their eyes, their intestines outside of their stomachs. Children born with tails. Some of these birth defects do not even appear in modern medical journals.
Usually the mother during in a labor room asks whether she born a baby, male or female. Now she asks whether I born a baby without anomaly, a normal baby or not. She never asks about the sex of the baby nowadays.
Dr. Amar Ehsan is the director of the hospital. Day in and day out, he works overtime, struggling to cope with a medical crisis that has reached pandemic proportions in southern Iraq. Dr. Amar says that the rampant cancer and birth defects in the area can all be traced to one thing: Washington's use of depleted uranium weapons against Iraq during and since the Gulf War.
We are suffering from the effect of depleted uranium used in that war in 1991, because more than 80,000 tons of weapons used against my country. And you can imagine the quantity of depleted uranium containing in that huge amount used against my country. They say America and the British, they say we use depleted uranium in weapons only for 5 days, but this is not the truth. From the beginning of the war till the end, and even from time to time now, they use weapons containing depleted uranium. And here we detect the effect of that radiation on my people.
It's also a new diagnosis today, admitted with abdominal mass here. Abdominal mass operation was done and diagnosed as neuroblastoma. We start treatment. I now just tell the family there's no drugs, you can't afford drugs from outside. The father said to me, if this is not available, I want to take the child and go to the home and let the child to die peacefully at home if there is no drugs.
Dr. Janan Hassan heads up the hospital's cancer ward. The little girl she was just talking about is a four-year-old named Yisak. Every day, Dr. Janan deals with children dying of leukemia, which in countries like America or Britain would have a 95% chance of cure. In Iraq, because of severe shortages caused by the sanctions, doctors say only 3% have a chance of surviving. Dr. Janan has seen hundreds of children die before her eyes, children she says could have been saved with the most basic of medicines. Dr. Janan walks down the hall from four-year-old Yisak and enters a room with a filthy bed where a three-year-old boy named Sajid Majid lies, waiting to die. Sajid has severe leukemia, cancer of the blood. Dr. Janan believes he will not last more than 48 hours. Sajid's frail body is covered with chicken pox, but he's too weak to even scratch his scabs.
Hello.
Sajid Majid will die because the hospital cannot purchase the medicine necessary to treat him. The doctors at Basra Pediatrics say the UN sanctions prevent Iraq from importing the necessary drugs. Sitting beside Sajid, Dr. Janan says his is the human face of the war that never ended here in Iraq.
Until now, he don't receive exact treatment. Receive only one or two drugs, and most of the drug is missing. How you can treat cancer cases with one or two drugs? This can live by the help of chance of God. And most of the family look is very miserable because they hopeless of what happened here. I give medicine only for placebo, not accurate treatment he was received. It's one of the crime of the American crime. And if the Bush or Clinton, they know exactly what happened here, they hang themselves by themselves, I thought. And which crime were done by our children to receive this punishment? Only they are Iraqi children, believe me. The most of the children dying because of the cancer, congenital malformation, malnutrition, diarrheal disease. And this is one of the weapons, mass destruction against Iraq. This is not only use of chemical weapon, but also this is make everyone is illiterate, sick, and reduce the generation of the future. This one of the mass destruction against Iraq.
Far away from the pediatric hospital in Basra, Bush administration officials and congressional leaders in Washington continue to talk of uprisings from the Kurds in the north and the Shiites in the south against Saddam, the Sunni Muslim. Senators like Republican leader Trent Lott.
You know, I hope that the administration will, and it looks like they might, be developing a multifaceted approach to how we deal with Iraq. Not just a sledgehammer where we dump a few missiles on Baghdad. We tried that. A much more sophisticated thing. Some people say, oh, well, the Kurds, what can they do? Oh, the dissidents in South Africa, Iraqi, what can they do? That's the same people that said the Northern Alliance couldn't do anything in Afghanistan. You know, I think we should have radio broadcast into Iraq. I think we should support the dissident groups. I think we should encourage dissidents inside the country. I think we should supply them not just with desks and computers, but, you know, real things. And I think we should have
guns?
Yeah.
Trent Lott, or for that matter, President Bush, has never been to the south of Iraq, where the U.S. government holds the rare distinction of being more despised than Saddam. In 1991, after the Gulf War, the Shiites heeded Bush's father's call for them to rise up against the regime, only to find American forces stand idly by as Saddam's troops mercilessly crushed the Shiite rebellion. Overwhelmingly, the people of the south say they will never forgive America for this. Air raid sirens sound in the distance. The war that doesn't end has just struck the south of Iraq once again. The region is attacked on an almost daily basis by American and British warplanes operating in the so-called no-fly zones. Washington says its planes are there to protect the Shiite Muslims from Saddam, but everywhere people in the South say it's the American missiles that terrorize them. The Iraqi government says that more than 1,300 civilians have been killed in these attacks. Through the windy roads and alleys of the poor Al-Jumariya neighborhood in the southern port city of Basra lies a street now known as Missile Street. It was named after a deadly U.S. bombing on January 25, 1999, which killed four small children. Among the dead, a six-year-old boy named Haider. His mother, a primary school teacher, still carries his name. In Iraqi culture, a woman takes the name of her firstborn and is forever known as the mother of that child. On a hot June evening, Haider, the mother of Haider, sits on the floor in her home on Missile Street and remembers that morning in January.
Till now, I didn't forget what's happened in that day. In 1930, in the morning, we were sitting in the... I was teaching my children, and big voice and become nearly. Then a big bomb happened. The glasses of the windows and the dishes and cups, glasses in the kitchen, all of them fall down and broken. Then my faces and two children with me, Hindu and Al-Hamza, they were with me. But Mustafa and Haider, they were out in the street. Then our faces is full of blood because the glasses of the windows and the dishes. Then I left them and remember my two children, they were out in the street. I take my cover and run quickly to the street. I saw the street is full of smoke and dust, and it was like midnight. Then I run quickly and call my children. Haider, Mustafa, Haider, Mustafa. I didn't find them. At last, I saw a small hill of broken wood and iron and pieces of and dust. And then I said, my old son, Mustafa, Haider, full of blood. His face is, the blood is cover his face and his body, his head, and a circle of blood under his head on the ground. I didn't forget that, never. And he closed his eyes. Then I call him, touch him, and he didn't answer me.
Haider's other son, Mustafa, survived the attack. He lost two fingers and lives with shrapnel in his liver. Six-year-old Haider wasn't even alive when the Gulf War began. He wasn't alive when Saddam invaded Kuwait. His crime was playing in front of his house at the wrong time, on the wrong day, in the wrong country. Haider is one of the hundreds of thousands of Iraqi children who have been made to pay the highest price for policies and governments and interests over which they have no control. And it will be children like Haider who will once again be made to pay the price if George W. Bush decides to launch another full-scale war against Iraq in his quest to bring down Saddam. Indeed, it is these children who already pay the price on a daily basis, living their lives like walking targets, constantly hit by the sanctions and the bombs.
You've been listening to Collateral Voices, a documentary by Jeremy Scahill. Why make children like the ones in this documentary suffer and die? As Scahill reported for Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! In October, it's about oil.
It's an understatement to say that Baghdad is a congested city. Every street is jam-packed with cars, most of them from the 1980s and earlier. But no one here is concerned much about driving a gas guzzler. Fuel is practically free. In fact, it's cheaper than clean water. Much cheaper. A gallon of gas costs less than 5 cents. A liter of drinking water costs about a quarter. As the U.S. begins its major push for war at the United Nations, there is little doubt here that oil is once again fueling the crisis. Iraq holds the second largest oil reserves in the world, with more than 112 billion barrels. Add to that the more than 200 billion in potential reserves, and it's not difficult to understand why the oligarchy in Washington is gearing up for an attack. Worldwide, the demand for oil is on the rise, not just in the world's biggest consumer, the U.S., but also in large nations like Russia, China, and India. And as this demand grows, oil-producing countries are being pushed to increase their capacity. And if there's one place in Iraq where people know what the U.S. has to gain by taking over Iraq's oil industry, it's at the Ministry of Oil. Fala al-Hayat is the general director of Iraq's oil industry.
Where do you get the oil from? Saudi Arabia is approximately producing to capacity. It cannot, it tried to produce more oil, it cannot. The only potential country that could increase its capacity quickly, cheaply, and substantially is Iraq. It is not only it has the second largest reserve in the world, but potentially it has the largest oil reserves in the world. Secondly, it has already very great giant fields ready to be utilized. The amount of investment and the amount of time required to put these fields into production is minimal, 2 to 3 years. And then you immediately double its capacity from its present 3 million barrels per day to 6 million barrels per day, which is equivalent to the total spare capacity going in the world today.
This past June, Iraq marked the 30th anniversary of its nationalization of foreign oil companies by announcing that it was beginning oil exploitation at two sites that it described as gigantic oil fields. The West Ghorna and Majnoon fields lie in southern Iraq and have gone untapped for decades. They were repeatedly attacked during the Iran-Iraq War, as well as the Gulf War. West Ghorna, which is known here as the Giant, had been contracted to the Russian company Lukoil, but Iraq accused the company of bowing to U.S. pressure not to begin drilling. Fala al-Hayat says the fields represent two of the largest untapped reserves in the world.
We're talking about 500,000 barrels each, at least. Now this, together they'll make 1 million barrels a day. And that is as big as many OPEC countries. Now we're talking about the giant fields. At the tip of the Gulf, on a flat ground, not in the wilderness of Alaska or in the isolation of the Caspian Sea. You see, when you invest in oil, what is important is what's the reserve, is how much you can get out. Now, all this investment in the Caspian Sea, platforms, drillings, pipelines from Baku to the Mediterranean, going through countries and mountains and whatever, is to exploit a 15 billion barrels of oil. Now, 15 billion barrels of oil is equivalent to the reserves of the West Ghorna field second stage, which we have signed with the Russians, and they are a breach of its contracts. I just want to with this example, is to tell you what is the potential and the capability of the Iraqi oil industry. And it is sitting at the tip of the Gulf. Now, that is, if you control the Iraqi oil, right? Now, you are halfway there to control the world oil. You see? And with your substantial hold on the Saudi fields, then you are in complete control of oil supplies for a long time to come.
Despite Washington's constant threats against Iraq, the Bush administration certainly isn't putting its money where its mouth is. Iraqi oil continues to flow through the U.S. America's a major purchaser of Baghdad's oil, but it doesn't buy it directly from Iraq. Instead, American corporations buy Iraqi oil from French and Chinese middlemen. That's how Iraq's Basra oil ends up in the U.S.
American refiners love the Basra oil. It is optimized on their refinery. They get more yield from the oil than any other type of oil. And also, because of the distance from Basra to the USA, they get benefits out of the differential. So it's a bit cheaper, and it exactly fits the refinery. I love it. By the way, it's a known fact that we always sold our oil, lots of oil, to the United States, irrespective of the political situation. Probably that's why these people from Texas who rules the American administration is that they want to send us to Armageddon just to get their hands on the fields in Iraq.
Al-Khayat says this is why the oligarchy wants to send Iraq to Armageddon, just to get their hands on the oil fields. As the Bush administration begins its major push for a resolution at the UN that could pave the way for a massive attack on the country, the saying born during the administration of Bush the father rings true with his son in the White House. When it comes to Iraq, it's all about the oil.
And that again was independent journalist Jeremy Scahill in a report he filed for Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! You are listening to RISE, Radio Internet Story Exchange. I'm Kelly O'Ramaris. Today's topic is Iraq. Behind the headlines. Whatever happened to all the talk about a new oil utopia in the Caspian Sea and Central Asia? That is the question with which Dale Allen Pfeiffer, contributing editor for Energy at From the Wilderness Newsletter, begins an article called Much Ado About Nothing, Whither the Caspian Riches. It seems the original estimates were about 200 billion barrels, and now people are talking 9 to 15. This is a huge discrepancy. This is more than somebody forgetting to carry the one. How did that happen?
It'll wind up a little more than 9 or 15. So I believe the accepted number is about 30 billion barrels, known reserves, and expectations of maybe another 10 billion barrels. That's still not very big. That's about the size of the North Sea find. And according to the modeling done by Richard Duncan and others, it won't be enough to make any difference in the peak of oil production. I think that up until fairly recently, they had high hopes in the Caspian area, up until the results of this latest research came in.
You wrote an earlier article for From the Wilderness called Pipelinistan, which described all the pipeline projects in Central Asia. What's happening now with those projects?
Haven't heard much about most of them. Of course, Afghanistan is still such a troubled land that it just isn't a very handsome proposal to investors. And that's the bottom line there, I do believe. The only one that does seem to be moving is the Baku-Ceyhan pipeline running from Georgia to the coast of Turkey. And that one, I don't know, in light of recent developments, I would say that there probably isn't enough oil to make it worth their while to even complete that pipeline. Although Spencer Abraham certainly was touting it.
We have noticed some of the oil companies are leaving this area, actually.
Yes, yes. Some of the majors, Chevron, has pulled out of the area. Well, not actually pulled out of the area, but they've halted all further development, which amounts to the same thing.
So I would think this definitely increases the incentive to go to war in the Middle East to try to dominate the oil fields that are there. Do you think now that with these newer figures coming in and the oil companies deciding to back off, that the target is not only Iraq, but maybe Saudi Arabia as well?
Oh, Iraq, Iran, and Saudi Arabia. I would not be surprised if they try and pull some sort of play in Saudi Arabia where they step in to help the royalty settle things there after the death of King Fahd and wind up splitting or partitioning the country into two halves a religious-centered Saudi Arabia centered around Mecca and Medina, and an oil military protectorate in the other side of the country. But I think they're going to start turning their attention to other goals as well, getting a little more serious about other things possibly.
Such as?
Well, South America. There are important reserves of oil in South America and Colombia and Venezuela. And
Hugo Chavez is warning about a possible coup attempt again.
Yes, yes. Ben, how many of them so far?
Losing count. But then that's always been the story of Venezuela.
Yeah.
Now it looks like the Caspian Central Asia is a bust.
Well, it's always strategic. You know, there's Central Asia is a strategic area. If you have a strong base of operations in that area, you could move in many directions.
Yeah, it does look from the map that's on from the wilderness from the previous article about the troop placements that if you've got your troops in Iraq, they can pretty much pivot anywhere they want to in that region.
Yeah.
And it just seems to be such folly in the sense that the military uses so much oil when they do their campaigns. It feels like we're wasting oil to get oil.
Yes, they do not see that. They do not see that. They aren't looking at the energy expense of a lot of things, but then their sight seems to be way off in many ways.
That was Dale Allen Pfeiffer, contributing editor for Energy for From the Wilderness newsletter. His articles can be found at www.fromthewildernessoneword.com. Pfeiffer is also featured in part 3 of our series, The End of the Age of Oil, which is available at www.riseforenews.net. According to British Member of Parliament George Galloway, the motives behind military action against Iraq go well beyond the borders of that country, or even of Saudi Arabia, as Dale Allen Pfeiffer suggested. In an interview with Free Speech Radio news reporter Sasha Lilly, Galloway discusses possible Western plans to redraw the map of the entire Middle East.
British Member of Parliament and Senior Vice Chairman of the Parliamentary Labour Party's Foreign Affairs Committee, George Galloway, says that ministers and other eminent figures within the British government have actively discussed with him the forcible division of Saudi Arabia, as well as Iraq, Egypt, Sudan, Syria, and Lebanon. Galloway, who has close relations with the Ministry of Defense, says that this is propelling the drive for war with Iraq.
Well, I think the notion that the United States is going to shake the earth with a war against Iraq because of Iraq's acquisition of certain banned weapons or because Saddam Hussein is not a particularly pleasant fellow is ludicrous. The war aims are much wider than that, and they include a recasting of the entire Middle East, the better to ensure the hegemony of the big powers over the natural resources of the Middle East, and the safety and security of the vanguard of imperialist interests in the area, the State of Israel. And part of that is actually redrawing boundaries.
British intelligence has reported that in Saudi Arabia there is a great deal of resentment about the presence of U.S. troops on Saudi soil since the Gulf War, which has fueled support for Osama bin Laden in many quarters. Galloway says that the Saudi royal family could not but deny the United States use of its bases for an attack on Iraq, as the domestic backlash against such support would imperil the very survival of the Saudi government. George Galloway claims that the U.S. is well aware of this.
They realize that Saudi cannot give its bases to the United States for an attack on Iraq precisely because the regime is so unstable and so vulnerable to overthrow, which in a sense buttresses the fears that one day this House of Saud is going to lose its position. And like the tyrant Shah of Persia, it will come crashing down to the ground. And just like in the case of the Shah, because the United States had put all of its eggs in the tyrant's basket, they were all broken when the tyrant fell.
According to Member of Parliament Galloway, the fear that an anti-U.S. Islamic fundamentalist regime may come to power and cut the West off from the world's greatest source of oil has grown as the future of the ruling House of Saud remains unclear and a power struggle continues behind the ostensible leadership of the incapacitated King Fahd.
The United States in particular has lost confidence in the ruling family in Saudi Arabia, so far as their interests are concerned. They realize that the radicalization of the Saudi Arabian population has proceeded at very great pace, has reached very great depths, particularly amongst young people. And one of the fallback positions would be to withdraw their forces from the parts of Saudi Arabia which are sacred to Muslims and to keep their forces purely in the eastern province, and then to argue for some kind of redrawing of Saudi Arabia's boundaries. Saudi Arabia could easily be two, if not three, countries, which they go on to say would have the helpful bonus of avoiding foreign forces having to occupy the holiest places in Islam when they're only interested, really, in the oil wells in the eastern part of the country.
Since the end of World War II, the U.S. and Saudi Arabia have had a tacit agreement that gives the United States unique access to Saudi oil in exchange for protecting the Saudi royal family from external and internal threats to its rule. However, that agreement seems to be fraying. This past summer, an analyst from the RAND Corporation presented a briefing to the Pentagon's Defense Policy Board that advised the U.S. government to demand Saudi Arabia stop supporting hostile fundamentalist movements or face the seizure of its oil fields.
And that was Free Speech Radio news reporter Sasha Lilly. You have been listening to RISE, Radio Internet Story Exchange, a weekly public affairs program helping you to ask questions, find answers, and distinguish the truth from the lie. Special thanks to Jeremy Scahill and www.iraqjournalonword.org for furnishing the documentary Collateral Voices. iraqjournal.org is a group of independent journalists and activists coordinated by Jeremy Scahill and Jacqueline Suen on the ground in Baghdad. iraqjournal.org reports are not edited or censored by any government. Thanks also to Sasha Lilly and Free Speech Radio News for the interview with British MP George Galloway. Free Speech Radio News archives are at www.fsrn.org. That's fsrn.org. Thanks also to Democracy Now! For Jeremy Scahill's report, It's About Oil. Democracy Now! Is archived at www.webactiveoneword.com. That's webactiveoneword.com. Radio Internet Story Exchange is produced by myself, Kelly O'Ramaris, in part at the studios of radio station KPFA 94.1 FM in Berkeley, California. RISE programs are archived on our website, www.rise4news.net, and they're also webcast on the Partytown streaming network, www.partytownoneword.com. That's www.partytown.com. And today we welcome another webcaster, Lover, Love Underground Visionary Revolution, to the RISE fold. Listen to Lover online at www.luver.com. That's luver.com. Radio Internet Story Exchange receives no corporate or foundation funding and depends on you for support. For more information on donating to RISE or promoting or receiving the program, please email Kellia at riseforNews.net. That's K-E-L-L-I-A at RISE, the number 4, news.net. This has been RISE, Radio Internet Story Exchange. Thanks for listening.